The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you for coming. So this is a novel about the latest installment in the long-running dialogue between science and religion, faith and reason. It's about the new atheists and those who aren't new atheists. The novel takes place over the course of 1 week with several incursions from the past. And just like the debates themselves, the voice of this novel is sometimes reflective, but often raucous, full of large and insistent and assertive characters. There's an extreme distinguished professor of faith, literature, and values who has suspect messianic obsessions. There's an anthropologist whose Amazonian hunter-gatherers have christened her with a name that means in their language a whole lot of woman. There's a very small mathematical genius, the only son of a Hasidic Rebbe, who's destined himself to inherit the role of Rebbe, and he sees the numbers and he thinks of them as angels. And a lot of other characters. It's a bit crowded. But though the book is somewhat boisterous, it starts off quietly, and I'm going to read to you from one of the quiet sections, in fact, a condensed version of the first chapter. It's called The Argument from the Improbable Self. All of the chapters, there are 36 chapters, all of the chapters have the argument from something weird. Okay. Something shifted. Something so immense you could call it the world. Call it the world. The world shifted, catching lots of smart people off guard, churning up issues you had thought had settled forever beneath the earth's crust. The more sophisticated you are, the more annotated your mental life, the more taken aback you're likely to feel, seeing what the world's lurch has brought to light. Thrusting up beliefs and desires you had assumed belonged to an earlier stage of human development. What is this stuff, you ask one another, and how can it still be kicking around given how much we already know? It looks like the kind of relics that archaeologists dig up and dust off, speculating about the beliefs that once had animated them to the best that they can be reconstructed. Gone as they are now, those thrashings of proto-rationality and mythico-magical hypothesizing and nearly forgotten. Now it's all gone unforgotten, and minds that have better things to think about have to divert precious neuronal resources to figuring out how to knock some sense back into the species. It's a tiresome proposition having to take up the work of the Enlightenment all over again, but it's happened on your watch. You ought to have sent up a balloon now and then to get a read on the prevailing cognitive conditions, the thinks watching out for the think-nots. Now you've gone and let the stockpiling of fallacies reach dangerous levels, and the massed weapons of illogic are threatening the survivability of the globe. None of this is particularly good for the world, but it has been good for Cass Seltzer. That's what he's thinking at this moment, gazing down at the frozen river and regarding the improbable swerve his life has lately taken. He's thinking his life has gotten better because the world has gone bonkers. He's thinking zealots proliferate and Seltzer prospers. It's 4 a.m., and Cass Seltzer is standing on Weeks Bridge, the graceful arc that spans the Charles River near Harvard University, staring down at the river below, which is in the rigor mortis of late February in New England. The whole vista is deserted beyond vacancy, deserted in the way of being inhospitable to human life. There's not a car passing on Memorial Drive, and the elegant river dorms are darkened to silent husks, the most hyperkinetic of undergraduates sedated to purring girls and boys. It's not like Cass Seltzer to be out in the middle of an icy night, lost in thought while losing sensation in his extremities. Excitement had gotten the better of him. He had lain in his bed for hours, mind racing, until he gave up and crawled out from under the luxe comforter that his girlfriend, Lucinda Mandelbaum, had brought with her when she moved in with him recently. This comforter has pockets for the hands and feet and a softness that's the result of impregnation with aloe vera. As a man, Cass had been skeptical, but he's become a begrudging believer in Lucinda's comforter and in her Tempur-Pedic pillow, too, suffused with the fragrance of her coconut shampoo, making it all the more remarkable that he'd forsake his bed for this no-man's stretch of frigid night. Rummaging in the front closet for some extra protection, he had pulled out a long-forgotten item, the tricolor scarf that his ex-wife, Pascal, had learned to knit for him during the 4 months when she was recovering from aphasia. 4 months that had produced, along with other shockers, an excessively long French flag of a wool scarf, which he wound 7.5 times around his neck before heading out into the dark to deal with the rush in his head. Lucinda's away tonight, away for the entire bleak week to come. Cass is missing Lucinda in his bones, missing her in the marrow that's presently crystallizing into ice. She's in warmer climes at a conference in Santa Barbara, a non-Nash equilibria in zero-sum games. Among these equilibria is one that's called the Mandelbaum equilibrium, and it's Cass's ambition to have the Mandelbaum equilibrium mastered by the time he picks her up from the airport Friday night. Technically, Lucinda's a psychologist, like Cass, only not like Cass at all. Her work is so mathematical that almost no one would suspect it has anything to do with mental life. Cass, on the other hand, is about as far away on the continuum as you can get and still be in the same field. He's so far away that he's knee-deep in the swampy humanities. For close to 2 decades, Cass Seltzer has all but owned the psychology of religion, but only because nobody else had wanted it. But now things had happened, fundamental and fundamentalist things, and religion as a phenomenon is on everybody's mind. And among all the changes that religion's new towering profile has wrought in the world, which are mostly alarming, if not downright terrifying, is the transformation in the life of one Cass Seltzer. First had come the book, which he had entitled The Varieties of Religious Illusion. The book had brought Cass an indecent amount of attention. Time magazine, in a cover story on the so-called New Atheists, had singled him out as the only one among them who seems to have any idea of what it feels like to be a believer, and had ended by dubbing him the atheist with a soul. That always cracks me up. I don't know about you, but I find it funny. Next had come the girl, although that designation hardly does justice to the situation, not when the situation stands for the likes of Lucinda Mandelbaum, known in her world as the goddess of game theory. And now, only today, as if his cup weren't already gushing over, had come a letter from Harvard, laying out its intention of luring him away from Frankfurter University, located in nearby Ouida, Massachusetts. Cass has the letter on him right now, bearing the insignia of Veritas, zippered into an inside pocket of his parka, insulating him against the cold. The night is so frigid that everything seems to have been stripped bare of superfluous existence, reduced to the purity of abstraction. Cass has the distinct impression that he can see better in the sharpened air and takes off his glasses and, of course, can hardly see a thing past the nimbus phantom of his own breath. But then he stares harder and it seems that he can see better, that the world has slipped into sharper focus. It's only now that he catches sight of the spectacle that the extreme cold has created in the river below, frozen solid except where it's forced through the three arches of the bridge's substructure, creating an effect that could reasonably be called sublime, and in the Kantian sense, not cozily beautiful, but touched by a metaphysical chill. The quickened water has sculpted three immense and perfect arches into the solid ice, soaring 50 or 60 feet to their apices, sublime, almost as if by design. Standing dead center on Weeks Bridge, in the dead of winter, in the dead of night, staring down at the sublime formation, Cass is contemplating the strange thing that his life has become. To him, his life has become strange to him. He feels as if he's wearing somebody else's coat, grabbed in a hurry after a boozy party. He's walking around in somebody else's bespoke cashmere while that guy's got Cass's hooded parka, and only Cass seems to have noticed the switch. What has happened is that Cass Seltzer has become an intellectual celebrity. He's become famous for his abstract ideas, and not just any old abstract ideas, but atheist abstract ideas, which makes him, according to some of the latest polls, a spokesperson for the most distrusted minority in America, the one that most Americans are least willing to allow their children to marry. This is a fact. Studies have found that a large proportion of Americans rate atheists below Muslims, recent immigrants, gays, Jews, and communists in, quote, sharing their vision of American society, unquote. Cass Seltzer has become the unlikely poster boy for this group. His is a good face for counteracting the fallacy of equating godlessness with vice. Cass's fundamental niceness is written all over him. He's got a strong jaw, a high ovoid forehead from which his floppy auburn hair is only just slightly receding, and the sweetest, most earnest smile this side of Oral Roberts University. The atheist with a soul. Cass always smiles at the absurdity of the phrase. But which is the more absurd element? The truth is, and what's the good of a man contemplating an inhumanly frozen world at 4 a.m. if no truth-telling ensues, that Cass is somewhat at a loss to account for what he's done. How to explain those 36 arguments for the existence of God? See appendix. All of them formally constructed in the preferred analytic style, premises parading with military precision, and every shirking presupposition and sketchy implication forced out into the open and subjected to rigorous inspection. Cass had started out with all the standard arguments for God's existence, the ones discussed in philosophy classes and textbooks, the cosmological argument number one, the ontological argument number two, the classical teleological argument number 3a, the arguments from miracles, moral truths, and mysticism, numbers 11, 16, and 22, respectively, Pascal's wager, number 31, and William James's argument from pragmatism, number 32. He had analyzed the new batch of arguments recently whipped up by the intelligent design crowd, to wit, the argument from irreducible complexity, number 3b, the argument from the paucity of benign mutations, number 3c, the argument from the original replicator, number 3d, the argument from the Big Bang, number 4, the argument from the fine-tuning of the physical constants, number 5, and the argument from the hard problem of consciousness, number 12. But he had gone beyond these, too, attempting to polish up into genuine arguments those religious intuitions and emotions that are often powerfully evocative, but too subsyllogistic to be regarded as actual arguments. He had tried to capture under the net of analytic reason those fleeting shadows cast by unseen winged things darting through the thick foliage of the religious sensibility. So, for example, he had formulated the argument from the improbable self, number 13, struggling to squeeze into precision the sense of paradox he knows too well, the flailing attempt to calm the inside-outside vertigo to which he's given at odd moments in his life, but which he can always reliably bring upon himself by staring too long at the improbable fact of his being identical with himself. If somebody hasn't personally experienced this particular kind of metaphysical seizure, then it's hard to find the words to give a sense of what it's like. Cass had experienced it even as a boy, lying in bed and thinking his way into the sense of the strangeness of being just this. Cass had the lower bunk bed. Both he and Jesse, his younger brother, had wanted the higher bunk bed, but as usual, Jesse had wanted what he wanted so much more than Cass had wanted it, with a fury of need that was exhausting just to watch, that Cass had let it go. Lying there awake on his lower bunk, Cass would think about being himself and not being Jesse. There was Jesse, and here was Cass. But if somebody else were looking at the two of them, Jesse there and Cass here, how could that person tell that he, Cass, was Cass here and not Jesse there? If it got switched on them, everything the same about them, the body and memories and sense of self and everything else, only now he was Jesse there. No. Only now he was Jesse here. And there was Cass there. How would anybody know? How would he know? How would Jesse? Maybe a switch had already happened. Maybe it happened again and again. And how could anybody tell? The longer he tried to get a fix on the fact of being Cass here, the more the whole idea of it just got away from him. If he tried long enough to grasp it, then he could get the fact of being Cass here to blank out of existence and then come dribbling weakly back in like a fluorescent fixture flickering on and off toward death. He would get the sense of having been shot outside of himself and now was someone who was regarding his being Cass Seltzer as something like his being in the sixth grade, just something about him that happened to be true. Who was that other that he was who was regarding his being Cass Seltzer as if he didn't have to be Cass Seltzer? The sense of giddiness induced by these exercises could be a bit too overwhelming for a kid in a lower bunk bed. It could be a bit overwhelming still. Here I am, Cass is saying, standing on Weeks Bridge and talking aloud into the sublimely indifferent night. Cass knows he needs to tamp down his tendencies toward the transcendent. It isn't becoming an America's favorite atheist, who is, at this moment, Cass Seltzer, who is, somehow or other, just this. Here I am. How can it be that of all things one is this thing, so that one can say astonishingly, in the right frame of mind, it is astonishing, with the metaphysical chill blowing in from afar, here I am. When you didn't force yourself to think in formal reconstructions, when you didn't catch these moments of ravishment under the lenses of premises and conclusions, when you didn't impale them and label them like so many splayed butterflies, bleeding the transcendental glow right out of them, then what? It's even hard at a time like this to resist the shameful narcissistic appeal of reasonings like the argument from personal coincidences, number 8, and the argument from answered prayers, number 9, and the argument from a wonderful life, number 10. William James had rebuked the scoundrel logic that calculates divine providence from one's own little goodie bag of gains, and Cass couldn't agree more with the spirit of James. But here it is, his bulging goodie bag. And call him a scoundrel for feeling personally grateful to the universe when at this same moment that he is standing on Weeks Bridge and tossing hosannas out into the infinite universe, there are multitudes of others whose lives are painfully constricting with misfortunes that are just as arbitrary and undeserved as his own expansive good luck. But Cass Seltzer does feel grateful. At moments like this, could Cass altogether withstand the sense that, hard to put it into words, the sense that the universe is personal, that there is something personal that grounds existence and order and value and purpose and meaning, and that the grandeur of that personal universe has somehow infiltrated and is expanding his own small person, bringing his littleness more into line with its grandeur, that the personal universe has been personally kind to him, gracious and forgiving to Cass Seltzer, gratuitously, exorbitantly, divinely kind, and this despite Cass's having with callowness and shallowness of forethought thrown spitballs at the whole idea of cosmic intentionality? No, that doesn't capture it either. Those words are far too narrowed by Cass's own particular life, when what it is he could feel, has felt, might even been feeling now, has nothing to do with the content of Cass's existence, but rather with existence itself. What? This expansion out into the world, which is a kind of love, he supposes, a love for the whole of existence that could so easily well up in Cass Seltzer at this moment, standing here in the pure abstractions of this night and contemplating the strange thisness of his life when viewed sub specia eternitatis, that is to say, from the vantage point of eternity, which comes to us so highly recommended by Spinoza. Here it is, then. The sense that existence is just such a tremendous thing. One comes into it astonishingly. Here one is, formed by biology and history, genes and culture, in the midst of the contingency of the world. Here one is. One doesn't know how, one doesn't know why, and suddenly one doesn't know where one is either, or who or what one is either, and all that one knows is that one is a part of it, a considered and conscious part of it, generated and sustained in existence in ways one can hardly comprehend. All the time conscious of it, though, of existence, the fullness of it, the reaching expanse and pulsing intricacy of it. And one wants to live in a way that at least begins to do justice to it. One wants to expand one's reach of it as far as expansion is possible, and even beyond that, to live one's life in a way commensurate with the privilege of being a part of and conscious of the whole reeling, glorious, infinite sweep, a sweep that includes so improbably a psychologist of religion named Cass Seltzer, who, moved by powers beyond himself, did something more improbable than all the improbabilities constituting his improbable existence could have entailed, did something that won him someone else's life, a better life, a more brilliant life, a life beyond all the ones he had wished for in the pounding obscurity of all his yearnings, because all of this, couldn't belong to him, to the man who stands on Weeks Bridge, wrapped round in a scarf his once beloved ex-wife Pascal had knit for him for some necessary reason that he would never know, perhaps to offer him some protection against the desolation she knew would soon be his and was, but is no longer, suspended here above sublimity, his cheeks aflame with either euphoria or frostbite, a letter in his zippered pocket with the imprimatur of Veritas, and a Lucinda Mandelbaum with whom to share it all. Thank you.
Thank you. That'll give you a taste of what to expect. At this point, we'll take questions. If anyone has them, please wait for the mic. Gentleman in front here.
Hi, thanks for coming. Would you be willing to share any of your thoughts or advice about overcoming the difficulties of combining philosophy and the writing of fiction?
Yeah. So would I be willing to share my thoughts about the difficulties of combining philosophy with the writing of fiction? There is a way in which they really do pull away from one another. And I am always aware, I always resolve never to write fiction anymore. And my last two books were nonfiction, one on Gödel's incompleteness theorems and one on Spinoza, Betraying Spinoza, the renegade Jew who gave us modernity. Some question, philosophical question that I'm thinking about, and I've been thinking very much about what's going on right now, the philosophical debate that has exploded on the public square between religion and science, faith and reason. And sometimes I feel like only a novel can do justice to the messiness and the confusions and the conflicts, to show how it's woven into lives and how these views aren't just abstract but embedded in, you know, points of view, conflicted points of view. And that's when I'm, you know, driven to write a novel against my own better instincts. So I understand what you're saying. And the way I overcome it is I convince myself that I can't really do justice to the full issue, the full philosophical issue, unless I turn to fiction. There are just sort of the political difficulties of that. My philosophical colleagues who think that this is always, they've gotten used to me now, and once I got the MacArthur genius, it was like, okay, Rebecca, you can do it, all right. But it was, it was a very compromising thing to do, to write these novels with philosophical themes. It seemed to show I was not really a serious philosopher. It was bad enough I was a woman in philosophy of science, you know, that there were so few, but to actually then, you know, write novels seemed... So, you know, well, that's very personal to me because I'm a professional philosopher. But how do you do... I don't know. You know, you just... If there's a philosophical problem and you feel it has to go into lives, you have to show how this is embedded in lives and how it moves people, then you work it out in fiction. The best way, of course, to learn how to write fiction is to read tons and tons of fiction, to love it passionately, and to love what it's able to do, nothing I think can do what the novel can do in terms of showing what philosophical issues really mean to us. Very practical advice you're not going to get from me, as you can see. Yes.
Another question.
I have two. One very quick one. I know that the number 36 figures into the plot in a couple of ways, but were you aware that 36 is the division number of the Psychology of Religion for the American Psychological Association?
No.
Okay. And the other question is...
I'm very pleased to learn that.
Yeah, that's a nice coincidence. The other one is you have the arguments for the existence of God being pushed into an appendix. Is that an expression of your own feeling about the more important human project that needs to be addressed and pursued?
Yeah.
And this debate might just belong in an appendix.
Yeah. Cass Seltzer writes this book, and he appends this appendix. He attaches this appendix as a kind of afterthought of these 36 arguments, and I attach the same appendix. This is not my appendix. This is Cass's appendix. And there's a sense that he feels and that I feel that religion is about much, much more than belief in God and grounds for God. And you can demonstrate the flaws, and they are all flawed, in the arguments for God's existence, and it's not going to make all that much difference, that there's a human dimension that goes into, and that the religious sensibility is very, very complicated. And Cass Seltzer himself has this sensibility. He resists it. I mean, it happens again and again. You see it at the end of the first chapter. But he knows what a kind of religious rapture is. He keeps it at the level of a Spinozistic rapture. It's a rapture about existence itself and doesn't take it to the next transcendent level. But this, you know, he is an atheist with a soul. But yes, another way in which I feel this is more complicated, these issues, and I am aligned, whatever the word is, with the new atheist. I'm on Sam Harris's board, his Reason Foundation. I'm one of the two token women. And it is, you know, so I don't make any bones about that, but I do feel that it's much more complicated than just demonstrating the fallacies in these arguments for God's existence. And I do feel also that the psychology of religion is much more complicated than just, you know, stupid people. it's not a gross falsification and simplification. So I find myself, the more I talk to people, that I agree with, the more I get offended when they describe people with whom I don't agree, actually. And that was also very much a motivation in writing the novel.
Next question. The lady in the middle in the gray, could you keep your hand up and we'll get a mic to you?
I was wondering, for the mind-body problem, if you would be willing to share whether any or much of it was autobiographical in terms of the heroine in the book.
Oh, it was all autobiographical. you know, she shared some of my background. She had come from an Orthodox Jewish family. I had too. She broke away from hers far sooner than I did mine. She was more rebellious than I. I gave her my father. My father had just died when I wrote that novel. That had a lot to do with my turning to writing fiction. I was a very young assistant professor at the time, and the last thing I needed to do to convince people I was serious was to write a novel. But there was, you know, his dying had something to do with, somehow, you know, here I was a philosopher, but I didn't know really how to deal with grief. I had also just given birth to my first child. I didn't really know that much about motherhood. And it was, this put me in this kind of meta-philosophical state of, philosophy itself is a meta system. It's always about other things. But I was being meta, you know. It's like, what is philosophy about? I was 26 and seemed to me, although I was a philosopher, probably knew much less about these kinds of real-life human questions than your typical 26-year-old. So that's where it was coming from. But I gave her some elements of myself, and I gave her my father. I think that that's the most autobiographical part of it. As far as I remember, I haven't read it in decades. I don't think I've read it since it was published. No.
Next question.
First, I'm a profound admirer of your work. Last week, I happened to have seen a very brief and interesting interview that you had given to Tablet Online magazine, and you were talking about the book. And in the magazine article, you said something. It was about there being substantial evidence to the contrary with respect to the existence of a transcendental God. Was a very tantalizing thing, and I'm just wondering if, other than just human evil, natural catastrophe, whether there's some other evidence that you were speaking of.
I don't know what I was talking about. But I mean, like, I spoke to that young woman for like hours, and I haven't seen what came out. It was probably very short and very condensed. Yeah.
I don't see evidence of that, and I do see a lot of evidence that it isn't.
Okay. No, you know, I should say, you know, I spent a very long time as a religious person, so it's not, this is sort of a continuing process. Much anguished thought has gone into it. And, you know, so when I say that I'm now, you know, not a believer, I hate the word atheist, actually. I don't think that this a group should be defined by what it doesn't believe in when there's so much that we do believe in. I so much more prefer secular humanist, you know, which is a positive statement of what we believe in. But well, I can't believe I'm actually we believe in. I'm defining myself as belonging to a group. I've never done that. It sounds very odd. Anyway, I see it as a kind of three-pronged argument. I mean, if anybody cares how, you know, what... I mean, there's, first of all, the arguments. And, you know, I come up with quite more than I think anybody else. Those appendix, in fact, my free-thinking friends told me that they've made it a little booklet, and they go around wherever they go with those 36 arguments. And there were actually more than 36 arguments because I had to start lumping them together because it had to be 36 because that's a special number in Judaism, you know, so it That's why it had to be 36. And, of course, when he's saying, here I am, that's echoing Abraham saying, here I am, when God calls out to him to sacrifice his son. So there's always, you know, I'm playing tricks with my atheist there. But the way, you know, I see it is you've got these arguments, many, many arguments, and they're not good. They're really not sound arguments. Then what you've had is, and I think this is one of the reasons that the new atheist really emerged in the last few decade, you have psychology, especially evolutionary psychology, has really developed. It's become almost a science. And psychology has become so much more of a science than when I was an undergraduate. And they've now turned to being able to explain things that they never would look at before. It's not rats running through mazes. It's things like belief. Why do we have this great tendency to believe supernatural beliefs, even if there's no evidence for them? And that's a sort of very Humean kind of double argument. First you show there's no good argument for something. Then you turn to psychology and say, here, nevertheless, is the way we're psychologically put together. So we, you know, there's a great tendency to believe in these things, nevertheless. And then for me, the third prong, and this is all just abstraction, is the nature of the world. And it is just, you know, theodicy, the problem of evil. The tremendous difficulties that a theist has to go through, the intellectual hoops he has to or she has to jump through to try to reconcile what happens in this world with there being a God who gives a damn. It's just, you know, there's free will. Okay, so maybe that explains the Holocaust, because if there's free will, there's a possibility of great evil. People are going to exercise it. But that only goes so far, you know. There's a whole lot of other suffering of innocence of children. I mean, we don't need today, this week, we really don't need to think about more empirical evidence for. So, yes. So it's for me like a three-pronged kind of argument. The first two, a kind of Humean slap this way, that way, and then just the nature of the world. You know, which to me means that we're all just very much in this together. We've got nobody else to depend on, and yeah.
Something on the lighter side, perhaps.
This is a very funny book, by the way. You wouldn't.
It is a very funny book. It's
I just saw on the web that your present day job is research psychologist in New Haven. Can you talk about that a little?
It's just a sinecure.
It's just what?
It's a sinecure. It means nothing. It means health insurance, really. And that I can, to be honest, I'm not really a psychologist. I mean, I give a graduate seminar every once in a while on the psychology of religion or the psychology of fiction, moral psychology, things that are an overlap with
turn it off.
This is the problem of evil in small. But yeah, it's not terribly interesting.
Does it seem to you that the humanities are moving more toward scientific explanation? I don't know if you saw the Times magazine this weekend and the interview with Terry Castle, literary critic. But she was just talking about how a lot of literary criticism is also considering scientific evidence, looking at brain psychology to explain away behaviors within literary characters, things of that nature.
I mean, I think evolutionary psychology in particular is very applicable. I mean, not entirely. Sometimes they think that they're answering everything, and that's very irksome to me. You know, there's moral psychology. But that's not answering the philosophical questions that you take up in ethics and in moral philosophy. So, but there is, you know, there is, I think that evolutionary psychology has brought science, I mean, it's brought psychology into the sciences, and it's also brought the sciences closer to the humanities. And there's been a kind of dyspepsia in the humanities, it seems to me. And, you know, where do we go from here? And, you know, postmodernism is so exhausted and exhausting. And so, you know, I think this is a kind of new infusion. And I do see when I go around to graduate school, you know, the one thing I still do, I'm not really teaching anymore, but I do lecture at universities a lot. And I always have lunch with the graduate students to keep in touch with what's going on. And I see among younger graduate students in the humanities a great interest in science and in particular in psychology.
A few more questions, gentlemen down here.
To quote Christopher Hitchens, he says that any assertion made without evidence can also be dismissed without evidence. Do you agree?
Well, if no evidence is of, I mean, people make statements without any evidence. That doesn't mean that no evidence is available or is possible. And I think that before you dismiss it, you have to try to make the very best case for it that you can make for it, even if the proponent of it isn't making a good case. I think that that's intellectual integrity. So that, but if you can find no grounds for it whatsoever, if it's just you want it to be that way, or you feel it in your guts, but there's no grounds that you could, so that you could make it reasonable to somebody else and say, here are my grounds. You see, I'm a reasonable person. Maybe you may not agree with me, but at least I have something here. If you have nothing of that sort to show somebody, I would say, you know, you're being irrational to believe it, not to say that we're not all of us irrational in our lives, and you know, one way or the other. But to believe in rationality, which I believe in, is to take that criterion seriously and to use it critically of yourself as well. So I would, you know, it's a bald Hitchens statement. I would say it needs a little bit of finesse, but finesse the right way, I agree with it.
Lady right behind that gentleman with her hand up.
I think you had some place in your book that James said, you quoted something about James in the Bible, that something about pragmatic, just believe that God exists. Well, I can understand why you don't believe, why you don't have the faith. When I have the faith, because I am simply here. You know, I didn't make myself, and there has to be a higher being, and I don't mean some intelligent Martian or something going around. There is a God just as well as there is a devil. I believe that. And I think that's, you know, that's just being inexistent, unless you're going to go on evolution, as they teach in schools. They used to teach it in schools. That's why they took the reading of the Bible out and saying a prayer or whatever during the morning.
Miss, do you have a specific question that you'd like to ask?
Well, yeah, that was just my statement. What I want to know is that if you do not believe in a God, just who do you believe in? I mean, the Bible states that there is the greatest book in the world. And it's all the explanation that you would need, and the fact that you are alive and that you are here.
Well, I do accept evolution very strongly. It's a very, very well-grounded, strong, beautiful theory with extraordinary explanatory scope and a tremendous amount of evidence. and I think a great explanatory power. So, a beautiful, beautiful scientific theory. I am always moved when I read the end of Darwin's The Origin of Species, when he talks about there's a grandeur in this view. So I recognize your emotions of the sense of wonder and the grandeur of the universe. I share that. And I understand, too, your great moral sense that you find validated in the Bible. I feel that, too, a great moral sense. I get it from a different source. And so I think emotionally you and I are probably closer than would appear. But our metaphysics are slightly different.
We've got time for one more.
Thank you for coming here. And I'm always wondered that one single building or one single thing cannot unite by itself. One single sheet of papers cannot fly and come together to become a sheet. Like, according to physics, everything goes towards entropy, which is that from arrangement to derangement. How can whole universe can arrange in such a beautiful manner on its own, or from even our own self, on a very micro level, our every organ, everything is united in a very perfect manner. And yes, the same thing we see in solar system, galaxies, everywhere we see. So how can this such a refined system can be thought that there is no evidence that this can, all this can stand on its own, all was created, like everything came in manner, like.
Yes, I think, you know, that kind of ontological wonder is a great source of religious belief. You know, that theists as well as scientists are trying to figure out the nature of this world. If you ask why particular things happen, they happen because of the laws of nature. So, if I put a drop of ink in the swimming or in a basin of water, it will disperse and not all, you know, and then will reverse itself so that it's dispersed, and then suddenly the ink will separate out and go back into being a little spot of ink. You know, the second law of thermodynamics tells us why that's the case. And that law is connected with other theories, with, thermodynamics, which is derived from the behavior of atoms through statistical mechanics. So, I mean, if you ask me, in some sense, your question, why do these things happen? Well, there are scientific laws that we're in the process of discovering, discovered a tremendous amount of them, not all of them. But maybe your question is, why is it these laws of nature and not another? Where did these particular laws of nature come from? So if we explain phenomena by reference to laws of nature, that's one thing. You can say, okay, you're squeezing out that way. But what if you're asking me, where did these laws of nature come from? And they tend to be quite beautiful, these laws of nature. So why these particular laws of nature? And, you know, there too, there are ways of trying to answer this question. There is, for example, the multiverse idea, which is getting a tremendous amount of play right now in cosmology and in foundations of quantum mechanics. There are many, many universes, and we happen to be in a particular one. They're all possibilities of universes, and we happen to be in a particular one, and we're asking, well, why this specific one? Well, it just happens to be the one that we're in and the one that supports conscious life, but that there is, you know, there are other possible universes. That is just one possibility. The thing is that cosmologists are playing around with these questions, which is amazing that they've gotten this far, that science has progressed this far, that this question is actually being considered. Why is there something rather than nothing? It's not amazing that we can't answer that yet. To me, it's amazing that we can answer anything. I mean, we are just, knowledge is hard. We are dense. We want to believe what we want to believe. We are, you know, the cast-offs of random processes of evolution. It's amazing we know anything about the universe. I mean, we can do string theory. That amazes me, right? That we can, our science has gotten within 3 seconds of the beginning of the Big Bang. This is pretty amazing. So it doesn't, there's this kind of argument from ignorance. We don't know something yet, and therefore we appeal to, well, God must be the answer. And we've used that, you know, we didn't understand life before, you know, that how could, what's the difference between animate and inanimate life? That was used as an argument for God's existence. Now, scientifically, we can fill in this, in the blank there. So it always seems to me at our particular stage of cognitive development, which is never complete. I mean, it's amazing we know anything. Surely we don't know everything. It always seems wrong at any stage of cognitive development to say, oh, we don't know that, must be God. That's lazy to me.
One thing I do know is that this is a terrific book, and Rebecca Neuberg Goldstein's a terrific writer. And it is a funny book. She's telling the truth.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.